Good morning, everyone. It seems very warm this morning. Maybe spring has finally arrived, so please do whatever you need to do to make yourself comfortable, including moving around during the talk. I have to begin by warning you that this is going to be a rather unusual Dharma talk. Usually with a Dharma talk in Zen, it's about something that can help us let go of concepts. And in a way, what I want to offer you today is a lot of concepts, a new story to replace what I think has become obviously a defective story, not only for us individually, but I think for our whole culture or even our whole civilization. Because today we not only have, obviously, for anyone who's been paying attention, an ecological crisis, an economic crisis, population crisis, add your own crisis. We also have, I think, a story crisis, which sort of underlies, in some way, those other problems. And by story here, I mean our basic understanding of what the world is all about, who we are, and our role in the world. So what I'd like to do is start out by just saying a little bit about why our present crisis, why our present story isn't working very well, and then also suggesting, pointing to this new story, which many people have been working on. But what doesn't seem to have been noticed so far is that Buddhism fits so well into this. And I think we'll be able to see that. I guess I should preface by saying something about how you may be wondering whether we need a story. I mean, isn't Zen practice all about letting go of our stories and just being right here, right now? Well, that itself is a story. But also, it's not so simple. I think even for those of us who practice Zen, there's still some kind of underlying, often unconscious or taken for granted story that we absorb from our culture about who we are and what it's all about. And even if it's not a problem for us, it's definitely a problem for our whole culture. And so that's what I want to zoom in on and suggest, look at this new story that seems to be evolving and see how I think Buddhism or our practice fits into that. So that's the plan. I want to start out by saying a little bit about the old story and then focusing on the new one. Make sense? Okay. When Charles Darwin published his theory of evolution, he refuted the last argument or proof for God's existence, the argument from design. That is to say, you needed a God or something like a God to explain these incredibly complicated organisms. How were they created? It must have been a God. With evolution, we had a different way of understanding it. And for many people, this was the last straw, as it were. Many educated, intelligent people now began to think we don't need any understanding that involves a God. The problem with this is that God traditionally was the source of meaning, value, goodness. God was the one who told us how to live and enforced it. Right? He would take care of us if we lived the way he told us to. He would punish us if we didn't. So when God disappeared, it left this huge void about meaning and what's it all about. A void that had to be filled one way or another. And it was filled. A very popular philosophy that developed around that time is actually called social Darwinism. That is to say, applying what Darwin seemed to be saying about how evolution worked in the natural world, applying it to societies as well. It's not only the Darwinist world of evolution of species, but human society too is a kind of jungle, where you have to crawl over the next guy on your way to the top, because if you don't, he's going to crawl over you. It wasn't Darwin himself, but Herbert Spencer, that coined the term survival of the fittest. And he was the one who developed what we call social Darwinism, applying what seemed to be Darwin's findings to society and understanding society in this way. And this is really important to notice, because Herbert Spencer was by far the most popular philosopher the United States has ever known, or you could even say probably the most popular intellectual. His ideas penetrated throughout the country. People, even sort of illiterate farmers in Oklahoma or wherever, they were talking about his ideas. They really penetrated. And it was only when I started looking into this I realized the progressive movement was a kind of reaction, to a large part, a reaction against this social Darwinism. And it had enormous impact upon what has become known as the robber barons, this great transformation in our economic system. So Andrew Carnegie, for example, he said that when he read Herbert Spencer, the scales fell from his eyes, and now he understood what it was all about, right? And John D. Rockefeller, the original Rockefeller, he gave a Sunday school sermon in which he compared the economic system with growing roses. And he made the point, you know, in order for this one rose to blossom in its fullness and its most beautiful, most fragrant, you have to nip off all the other buds around it. And I don't know whether he meant by the other buds his workers that he exploited or his competitors, but I'm pretty sure I know who he meant by the great blossom, right? Himself. This has fitted very much in with the American dream, right? Our individualism. If you aren't successful, don't blame anyone else. It's just part of this process, right? Now, today we don't hear very much about social Darwinism. That's not a term that's used, but we have contemporary versions like Ayn Rand, enormously influential on the neocons, including people like Alan Greenspan, the former head of the Federal Reserve for many years, who was actually a student of Ayn Rand. And he has said that he reads Atlas Shrugged, her great novel, every year. I don't know if any of you know that novel. I couldn't get through it once, so more power to him, right? But again, it's this whole basic idea. In fact, I want to suggest that this social Darwinism is at the heart of our economic system. The official justification for the kind of corporate consumer capitalism we have is something like Adam Smith, Invisible Hand. If everyone pursues their own self-interest, it'll work to the benefit of everyone. Well, a few economists might believe that, but you know, you scratch a CEO, and it's a social Darwinist world, right? Remember the film Wall Street? Greed is good. The uncomfortable thing about this from a Buddhist perspective is how much this ends up rationalizing what are for Buddhism very problematical motivations, that is to say, our greed, our aggression, and especially our delusion, this delusion of a self that can pursue its own benefit separate from or even indifferent or at the cost of the benefit of other people. This is very deep in our system, and I'm trying to relate it to this way of understanding what the world is really all about. In other words, it's a deluded worldview in Buddhist terms, but the problem is, of course, if enough people believe in it, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Society and our economic system becomes a kind of jungle, competitive jungle, and I would say that to a large extent it has. Please don't misunderstand me here. I'm not saying that this creates greed. Greed is there. But what's scary about this ideology, this story, which permeates our society, What's scary about this story is that it's actually an ideology, a philosophy, or even you could call it a religion that justifies greed, that says greed is good. You might say, well, okay, if this story doesn't work, let's take a Buddhist story. Problems. Which one? I mean, so many different Buddhist cultures, so many different Buddhist traditions. We have to remember, Buddhism began in Iron Age India, when people believed in gods, all sorts of things. So in the Pali Canon, we have stories about the Buddha levitating over a river while he's trying to stop two armies from fighting each other. The Buddha, after one argument, he rises into the air and then zooms off into the sky. He talks to tree spirits. He goes up to Tushita heaven to preach the Abhidharma to his deceased mother, things like this. I mean, there's a lot of Iron Age mythology there that I think most of us can accept, just isn't something we can just accept on its own terms anymore. We live in a different world, and whatever story we're going to have that's going to work for us has to incorporate, has to fit in with the best of what science has been discovering about cosmology and evolution. And so what I want to do is talk a little bit about the new story that people are coming up with and see how compatible it is with, I think, the basic Buddhist orientation. And of course, what we have to focus on first of all is evolution, which for so many religious traditions is very problematical because they have their own creation stories. Doesn't seem to fit in any literal way. From a Buddhist perspective, of course, with our emphasis on impermanence, interdependence, insubstantiality, actually evolution seems to fit in very well. It almost seems to be implied by something like basic Buddhist principles. So, what story are we talking about here? According to Brian Swim, a cosmologist who's one of the main people working on this new story, he says, the greatest scientific discovery of all time is that if you leave hydrogen gas alone for 14 billion years, plus or minus a few hundred million years, quote, it turns into rose bushes. There we are with rose bushes again. It turns into rose bushes, giraffes, and humans. The most important scientific fact ever discovered. The question is this also perhaps a very important spiritual discovery? What does that fact imply about the nature of hydrogen and whether we can simply understand it as this dead, inert kind of matter, stuff floating around? What's going on here? According to one Native American story, there are three miracles. The first miracle is that anything exists. The second miracle is that living things exist. And the third miracle is that living things exist that know they exist. And what's very nice about this is that this really fits in so well into the three parts of the evolutionary story, which don't begin with what we normally think of as evolution, you know, biological. That's only one part. We have to look at the whole sweep, which evidently starts with the Big Bang, or many Big Bangs. That's some interesting controversies. Big Bang, plasma, mostly hydrogen, a little helium. After a while, it cools down enough to form hydrogen, and then you have these big clouds of gas that coalesce. When they coalesce in the core of these big balls, so hot, so dense, so much pressure, they fuse, and the hydrogen is transformed into the heavier elements, like oxygen, calcium, and so forth. And then these stars later explode, they scatter their elements, and then you get secondary systems like ours which form, having not only hydrogen, but all of these other heavier elements that, it turns out, are what are necessary in order to have life as we know it. And that leads to the second kind of evolution, right? Biological evolution, the reproduction of, and the evolution of self-propagating organisms, the evolution of species and so forth, getting more and more complicated until you get to the third type of evolution, which is to say, once you get human beings, once you get speech, our forebrain, our opposable thumbs and those things, once you get that far, then there's a new type possible, social evolution, cultural evolution, which is necessary to create highly evolved beings like the Buddha or Einstein or Gandhi. And so here's the question. Usually we tend to think of these three quite separately, but what happens if we look at them all as part of one arc of transformation, of increasing complexification? What's really going on here? How can we understand this process? These three nested processes, because the higher ones, of course, require the earlier ones. Well, this is the great question. The old story, the old theistic story, is that there's a God that's directing this process. It's harder and harder to believe in that, although many people, many Christians do. On the other side, we have many scientific creative. Elsewhere, he says that the universe is not an accident, it's an enterprise. Others say evolution is, quote, an intelligent improvisational dance between organism and environment. In other words, to say it's inherently creative, it's not like there's some sonic score that's been written and that we're following out. Rather, it's something more improvisational, maybe like a jazz improvisation with countless instruments, huh? Or a dance where, as the dancers change the dance, the dancing changes the dancers, something like that. In order to understand what they're pointing to, it has something. We have to realize that the universe is not something that happens to be evolving. This process is itself the cosmos, which we are a part of. Again, from a Buddhist perspective, the world isn't a collection of separate things that just happen to interact in certain ways. Rather, the world we experience is a confluence of processes, and each of those processes dependent on lots of other processes. The scientists who want to say that the world is a machine, there was this old story, like Laplace, this 18th century scientist in France, believed if we knew the exact arrangement of every atom and we knew all the physical laws, then we could predict completely whatever was going to happen in the future. Well, quantum mechanics put an end to that fantasy. But it's very interesting, we still have this notion of the cosmos as a kind of a great mechanism. Right? It's like a big machine. That sort of, you know, little things happen here and there and it changes it. Elizabeth Sartoris, this evolutionary biologist, has pointed out this metaphor, and it's really a metaphor here, it doesn't work. It worked in the past because we believed in a God. If you're going to have a machine, our whole concept of a machine takes for granted a machine maker, someone who made the machine, supervises the machine. If there's no one doing that, it doesn't make any sense to call it a machine anymore. Or to put it this way, if you have a machine where it's constantly transforming itself, creating more complicated parts to itself, it's not a machine. We have to talk about an organism. Something much more like an organism. So instead of this tendency that so many of us have to reduce biology to physics, we need to turn that around and understand this as in a more biological terms, this transformation, which, as Dobzhansky says, this inherent creativity. Irvin Laszlo says, "We are a conscious part of the world, a being through which the cosmos comes to know itself. We are at home in the universe." And from a Buddhist perspective, this opens up really exciting questions. Can we understand this self-transformation of this great organism we call the cosmos? Can we understand this as the universe in its own kind of groping way, developing in order to become more self-aware? Does this answer that old question? If there's no self, who or what becomes enlightened? Is my desire to awaken, is your desire to awaken, looked at from the other side, less dualistically? The desire, the urge of the cosmos itself to become awake, to become self-aware. Is this what happened to the Buddha under that Bodhi tree? In the universe story, Brian Swim and Thomas Berry talk this way. Quote, "The mind that searches for contact with the Milky Way is the very mind of the Milky Way itself in search of its inner depths." What does this imply about Walt Whitman admiring some beautiful sunset? Quote, "Walt Whitman is a space the Milky Way fashioned to feel its own grandeur." If it's all interdependent, as Buddhism says, our eye, if in a way you can say it's the whole cosmos that created our eyes, thinking about all the process, in order, the eye is created by the cosmos in order to become, in order to look at itself, in order to experience itself. Is this how Buddhist enlightenment might be understood today? There's this old Mahayana saying, when the Buddha became enlightened, the whole universe became enlightened. That's actually in the Mahayana tradition. What did Dogen say after his own great awakening? Quote, "I came to realize clearly that mind is no other than mountains and rivers and the great wide earth, the sun and the moon and the stars." So when we forget ourselves and overcome this delusion of separateness, the delusion that I'm in here behind the eyes looking out at the world that's objective and external to me, when we forget ourselves and let go of ourselves, that external objective is no longer outside me because I'm no longer the inside. Nisargadatta expressed this so well when he said, "When I look inside and see that I am nothing, that's wisdom. When I look outside and see that I am everything, that's love. Between these two, my life turns, wisdom and love, the two wings of the Dharma." Right? If there's no inside, there's no outside. The outside is not outside. You know, each of us is one of the innumerable ways in which all of this is coming together right here and now. What the new story seems to be coming down to is the realization that the fundamental stuff of the cosmos itself, we can't reduce it to matter or even energy, but rather, because those are just particular forms, it seems to be the fundamental nature of the cosmos is creativity itself. Constant creativity, constantly creating new forms out of the old forms. And here's the interesting question. Do we have something in the Buddhist tradition that seems to fit in with this? I think we do. I think, in fact, as far as I can see, it fits perfectly into what Buddhism, especially clearly in Mahayana, is talking about. We have this term called shunyata, emptiness. And as we quoted, as we chanted at the beginning of our sitting this morning, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Isn't that what this new story is all about? There's a little bit of a problem here, because in the Buddhist tradition, shunyata is often understood in a kind of a static way, ironically, right? Simply means that nothing has any substantiality, any self-existence. Everything is dependent on everything else. But if we understand it in a more dynamic fashion, as this constant transformation, it would seem to fit in very well. As Shunryu Suzuki said it, this emptiness, it doesn't mean voidness, he says. There's something, but a something that's always prepared for taking some particular form. We can never know shunyata. It's not as though there's something that we can never grasp, but rather there's this basic potentiality, and that's the other side of the emptiness, the lack of fixed form, okay? That means that there's this constant potentiality, this pure potentiality, that because it's nothing in particular, can become anything. Constant transformation. Nagarjuna, who is the second most important person in the whole of the Buddhist tradition after the Buddha, he has a very interesting line in his Karikas. He says, quote, "The self-existence of the Buddha is the self-existence of this very cosmos. A Buddha has no self-existent nature." So he contradicts himself. He says, self-existence of the Buddha, self-existence of the cosmos. He says, the Buddha has no self-existent nature, nor does the cosmos have a self-existent nature. As Hakuin Zenji would put it, our self-nature, that is no nature. In our practice, we are working to realize the true nature of our own minds, which is empty. They have no fixed form. Our mind has no fixed form. As it says in the Diamond Sutta, let the mind arise without fixing it anywhere. This is the pure potentiality. It's when we realize that, when our minds aren't stuck in the way that they usually are, on grasping at this or that, including ideologies, including ideas, including stories, when the mind isn't grasping, then we realize this spaciousness, this ability to dance, to create. What's going on with this new story is that this is not simply the nature of our own minds. This is the fundamental nature of the cosmos itself. That's what it seems to be saying. So what it means is that same basic creativity that takes form as a mountain or a tree or a car, that's also taking form right here and now in my words and in whatever thought is taking form in your mind as you listen to these words. The same fundamental creative process taking form as us. And this is the sense in which we are at home in the universe. We are manifestations of that creativity. We're not accidents. Something is going on here. Now, I have to just say quickly, some Buddhist scholars don't like it when I talk like this about shunyata, because the whole point about shunyata is that shunyata shows us that dimension where there's no better and worse. There's no life, there's no birth and no death, you know, as we were chanting this morning with the Heart Sutra. And that's definitely true. We can call that the vertical dimension. From the shunyata perspective, there's no hierarchies. that you and I are no greater manifestations of this process than a cup, than anything else. There's no getting better or worse. And if, as is very possible, we end up destroying ourselves as a species, ecologically, there's no loss as far as shunyata is concerned. It will continue to take one form or the other. But still, there's this horizontal dimension. The fact that we can see, we can observe, something is going on. Forms transform. They become more complex. They become more aware. They become more self-conscious. And as we can see in Buddhism, this self-consciousness then can begin to awaken. I think this is really important because it helps us to understand this old question about whether there's anything special about being a human being or not. I've just explained the sense in which there's no superiority of a human being over any other species or animal or being, and yet we can also see that as we become, as life becomes more complex, say it this way, if the fundamental process is just this creativity, with human beings, new types of creativity become possible. New types of flourishing become possible. That's what we call human culture, in which we transform eating into dining. We transform mating and propagating into romance. We transform bird songs and music into symphonies. And we transform caves into cathedrals and so forth. These wonderful, beautiful examples of flourishing that are only possible because of human culture. Is this what it means in the Bible when it says that we're made in the image of God? Not that God has a vertical nose and two horizontal eyes, but if God is a metaphor for the creative process with us, these new types of creativity become opened up. With us, new species are created. Species like knives, poetry, cities, bridges, boats, world wars, concentration camps, nuclear bombs, and holocausts. The other interesting thing about human beings is, again, and this is the implication of the possibility we have that we can wake up, we are uniquely able in our practice to let go of everything and in the process learn to, by letting go of ourselves, we can learn to identify with the well-being of the whole cosmos. See, this is the bodhisattva. We can take it as our task that we're not simply concerned about our own selves individually or our family or our nation, but literally the well-being of the whole planet. And it's becoming ever more apparent that we are being called upon to do that. We seem to be in a kind of stage of the evolutionary process where the Earth is telling us something like, wake up or get out of the way. As if we can feel the impetus to do this if we're going to resolve the kind of crises that we're in today. What's pretty obvious, though, and now I'm starting to wrap it up, what's getting pretty obvious is that this hyper-creativity, it also comes with a problem. That as long as this incredible creative process is still limited by the sense of an ego self, a selfish self, not only individually but collectively, the self that distinguishes me from the rest of the world, my own well-being from the well-being of everyone else. As long as we have that process going on, this creativity gets distorted and we end up with things like holocausts and concentration camps and nuclear weapons and torture. The issue again is whether we're individually and collectively motivated by this delusion of a separate self that can exploit others for its own separate supposed benefit. And that seems to be the challenge. We need now, we seem to be in an evolutionary point where we need to evolve beyond that and to realize that that's almost like the next stage or the fourth stage. And that seems to be what we're doing when we're engaged in this process. Isn't it fascinating what science is learning, that the brain is plastic, it can change. And when we're meditating, the brain is changing, right? But now who's doing that? Well, when I'm meditating, I'm not doing it. I'm doing nothing in a way. I'm letting go of everything. The brain is rewiring itself when we're meditating, right? Again, what's going on there? Is this a further development of that creative process? Can we understand figures like the Buddha as a harbinger, as an example, as a model of the way in which we all have to develop? Prototypes of how our species needs to develop. In which case, the growing edge, the cutting tip of the whole evolutionary process right now is the kinds of spiritual practices that we're engaged in that are helping us to sort of make that further shift, that further development, helping to free us from individual and collective ego. It's really becoming clear that without the compassion that arises when we realize our non-duality with others, with the whole earth, it's becoming likely that civilization as we know it won't survive the next few centuries. Nor will it deserve to. What I'm really saying, of course, is that the eco-crisis isn't just a technological crisis or an economic crisis or a political crisis. It's also a spiritual crisis, if what I'm saying is right. The earth calling upon us to take this further step. And it remains to be seen whether the Homo sapiens experiment will be a successful vehicle. It's not at all clear. You could say all species are kind of experiments of the earth. In conclusion, but there is no conclusion, right? That's the whole point of it. If everything is empty in the sense of transforming, developing, this story is an empty story. But we need stories. We just have to realize they're empty stories, so we don't stick to them. If there's nothing of value in this story, it will be forgotten soon enough. If there is something of value here, then of course it's going to be developed, it'll be transformed, and whatever version this is will be forgotten. How wonderful. So I can bemoan the fact that, that fact, or I can celebrate, embrace being part of this deeper transformative process that flows, that takes form as all of us, that flows through all of us. Let me just finish with a couple lines of a poem by Rumi. More and more I like to end with a little poem. It's called A Worm Awakes. Talking about this awakening process, huh? This is how a human being can change. There's a worm addicted to eating grape leaves. Suddenly, he wakes up. Call it grace, whatever, something wakes him. And he's no longer a worm. He's the entire vineyard, and the orchard, too, the fruit, the trunks, a growing wisdom and joy that doesn't need to devour. And what I realize I forgot to say is when we wake, we realize we're not just the particular forms that this shunyata created process has become. We are itself the whole process, right? We are that which takes form, this particular form. So there's no conclusion, but I better stop. Thank you.